It is a wonderful opportunity to be together again this evening, to spend a few more moments this afternoon edifying one another in our singing and praying together as we remember those of our own number who have needs and others, and also to give glory to God and thanks to Him for the good things that He has brought into our life. And I appreciate the opportunity to stand before you and to talk to you a little bit this evening on the subject of when brethren disagree. If I were to say the names Paul and Barnabas, I suspect that for many of you, the first thing that would come to mind is that these were the two workers who teamed up in what we sometimes call Paul's first missionary journey. And yet in the beginning of that journey, it's always Barnabas and Paul, not Paul and Barnabas. But these two men worked together and accomplished a great deal, as Acts chapters 13 and 14 tell us. Barnabas, in fact, is known in the New Testament as the son of encouragement. And you see from time to time in the text of Acts, chapter 4, verse 36, for instance, chapter 9, when Saul of Tarsus, who's been converted, then tries to join the disciples at Jerusalem, it's Barnabas who brings him in and gets him joined to the disciples there in Jerusalem. They were afraid of him. When the Jerusalem church wanted to send somebody to encourage the new congregation in Antioch, they sent Barnabas. They sent the son of encouragement. In Acts chapter 15, there was a rather difficult question that was being asked. Difficult in the sense that it had the capacity, the ability, or the potential to divide these early disciples. It was the question of whether Gentiles need to be circumcised and to keep the law of Moses. And what's amazing about chapter 15 is that there's remarkable agreement about what needed to be done, about what the word of the Lord was with regard to that particular question. And yet, later in that chapter, what we read is that these two men who, at least their names bring to our minds cooperation and teamwork, those two men had a disagreement that was so strong that they were unable to work together in what we sometimes call the second missionary journey. Paul selected a different worker, as did Barnabas. You perhaps recall the cause for their dissension or for their disagreement. That's not really relevant for our study this evening, except to say that even among men of such stature as Paul and Barnabas, you still had a disagreement, a serious disagreement over John Mark and whether he ought to go on this second journey. I'll tell you what's surprising. It's really not the presence of disagreements. What's surprising is that there's not more disagreements between brethren, that is. We are so unique. We are so different. We have different personalities. Some of us are loud and gregarious, like Debbie, and some of us are kind of retiring and timid, like me. And then there are others who come from the West, some who come from the South. There are Yankees, like me, who have come to the South, to the good land. And we come from all different parts of the country. We even have had some members here in the past, the Simons, who came from New Guinea, halfway around the world. We have different backgrounds in terms of rural versus urban. We're from different generations. We have different preferences and different likes. What's surprising is not that occasionally we would disagree on things or that we would have some sort of disagreements. What's amazing is that we don't have more disagreements. When you begin to think about all of the things that are recorded for our consideration in the New Testament, the fact that we occasionally disagree on what some passage teaches or on some particular doctrine, the fact that we occasionally disagree in a group this size, frankly, is amazing. And it says something positive about the efforts that brethren do make in order to try to get along, in order to work together and to have harmony in a local congregation. But it is inevitable, because of our uniqueness and of our differences, it is inevitable that there will be disagreements. Some of them will be doctrinal in nature. Some of them will have to do with our behavior one toward the other. Some of it may just be my obnoxious personality that you it tends to grate on your nerves, and we may have some friction there for some reason. I can't imagine that, but anyway, it's a possibility. Many disagreements obviously are very minor. They don't require much attention to resolve. But my concern this evening is about the fact that some disagreements do put a wedge between persons. They have potential to split congregations. Now, people respond in different ways to disagreements. Some people blow up in anger. They have a short fuse, as we sometimes say. There are harsh words that get exchanged, and sometimes even within local congregations, relationships are just basically severed. And you have people who are worshiping in the same congregation, but they're not really acting like brethren. And then sometimes there's just constant bickering. What happens is you sometimes get two people or maybe two groups of people, and they disagree on things, and then they're trying to marshal support from all the other people who haven't been aligned yet. Kind of reminds you of a political race, doesn't it? Everybody trying to summon more support to their side. And may the Lord help any visitor who comes and decides to place membership, because he's going to be courted by both sides to see whether he'll go with this side or that side. And that's sometimes the way congregations handle disagreements. Sometimes what happens, though, is the topic is just kind of buried. Whatever it is that caused the disagreement, usually if it's a doctrinal thing, we just kind of bury it. And occasionally there'll be some sort of a temporary flare-up, usually not too serious, but we try to ignore those things. Or sometimes what happens is if I have a disagreement with somebody, I just avoid that person. Just don't speak to them. Try to avoid brethren. But my question tonight is, what should we do when brethren disagree? And we will. And my intention this evening is to encourage each of us to approach disagreements with brethren. And some of the things I'm going to say this evening obviously would have application in other relationships, even in the marital relationship or in other societal or social relationships. But I want to talk about how we should approach disagreements with some thought and some caution. I'm going to also, if time permits, suggest some guidelines for attempting to resolve disagreements. Now, I don't stand before you this evening as an expert in problem resolution. Sometimes I've violated the very things that I'm going to talk to you about tonight. But I think they're sound principles, and I would suggest them for your consideration. Webster says that dissension is violent disagreement, strife, discord. And if you have your New Testaments with you, turn to the book of Ephesians, the 4th chapter, if you would. Ephesians chapter 4. And consider with me, if you would, the last two verses of that chapter. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 31 and 32. Paul wrote, "Let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice." And then, of course, the opposite, the solution, "and be kind to one another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, even as God in Christ forgave you." I probably don't have to define the word clamor for any parent who has two or more children. But for those of you singles, or those of you only still have one child, clamor is loud quarreling. And if you are a parent, you will hear that. There are other passages that talk about the danger of clamor or loud quarreling between brethren. For instance, consider 1 Timothy the 6th chapter and verse 3. The Apostle Paul wrote to his young evangelist friend Timothy, "If anyone teaches otherwise and does not consent to wholesome words, even the words of our Lord Jesus Christ, and to the doctrine which accords with godliness, he is proud, knowing nothing, but is obsessed with disputes and arguments over words, from which come envy, strife, reviling, evil suspicions." To Timothy in his second letter in chapter 2, and verse 23, Paul warns Timothy about the danger of dissension or clamor. He says, but avoid foolish and ignorant disputes, knowing that they generate strife. Dissension is a bad thing. It will do at least three things, or has at least three dangers that I want to suggest to you. First of all, it destroys relationships. So frequently, dissension will destroy relationships that in many cases have been nurtured, that have grown, that have lasted for a long time. But dissension can tear them apart. I've known brethren who have been good friends and brethren for a long time. And then something comes up, something very volatile, something in which one of them or both of them are deeply wounded, and they part company, and they won't even talk to each other, despite the fact that they may even be in the same congregation or live in the same area. Dissension destroys relationships. Dissension distracts from the work of the local church. In some cases, what happens if there's a lot of strife in a congregation is we become kind of like an aquarium. Instead of going out and being fishers of men, we're too worried about what's going on in our own little tank. And all of our effort, all of our energies, our focus is concentrated on what's going on here. We're trying to solve our own problems and avoid people fluttering off to the four winds. And there's no time, there's no focus, there's no energy on what really we do need to concentrate on. And that is taking the gospel outside of this building, outside of our homes, and into the community where people are needing it desperately. And then third of all, and related to the second thing, and that is that dissension often dims the future of a congregation in the community. I am constantly amazed at what other people know about us. Oddly enough, you would think that we don't get enough advertising, but let a division take place in a local congregation and the community, people who have no connection with us hardly at all, they'll know about it. It'll become known. I have worked with congregations. I have worked in communities where there were congregations whose future was extremely limited in terms of their evangelism in the community, because everybody in the community recognized them as a congregation that just fought with each other. And their reputation was such that they were dissentious persons. They were constantly wrangling and there was strife in the congregation. Nobody wanted to be a part of that. Try and take the gospel out into the community when the community already thinks that you're worse than the world. And so dissension has a tendency to really dim the future of a local congregation in its own community with respect to personal evangelism. Well, I want to suggest to you at least four things that we need to think about as we talk about handling disagreements. What should we do when we perceive there to be a disagreement between us and a brother or brethren? First of all, I would suggest to you that we need to clearly identify the disagreement. Now, I understand that may seem kind of obvious, but has it occurred to you, or has it been such in your experience, that sometimes really no disagreement exists? That what is happening is that people are not communicating very well about what they believe or what they believe the problem is. Sometimes there are semantics involved. I'm saying something and you're saying something, and the fact of the matter is, eventually we discover that we really are saying the same thing, or at least so closely to the same thing, that there's really not any significant difference between what you believe and what I believe about something, but we're not communicating well with each other, and so as a result, there's a disagreement. We differ on something, the fact of the matter is. Sometimes the disputants are not even agreed on what the disagreement is. We just know we're at war. They find themselves eventually discussing two different topics. So may I suggest to you the very obvious, and that is if we do disagree with somebody, let's identify what the disagreement is. Let's be clear about what has caused this particular problem. In the second place, and I know this is going to sound a little strange, but we need to determine the significance of the disagreement. Now, let me tell you what I mean by that. We need to ask such questions as, does the disagreement stem from one's opinion about something? Now, our opinions are very important to us. I'm not minimizing anybody's opinion. But I would suggest to you that there are some things about which you and I might disagree that frankly are in the area of opinion or personal judgment, and they just don't qualify for a lot of discussion, certainly not dissension, not disagreement. If our disagreement does stem from each other's opinion, is it really worth discussing any further? Now, I've known brethren, and perhaps you have also, everything is so important, every issue, every thought or opinion that this person has is elevated to a matter of extreme importance, and everything has to be fought out. And frankly, that just doesn't edify a local group. It's unnecessary. Many of you do not agree with me on various things. Some of you don't agree on the date of Revelation. I'm an early dater. Some of you are late daters, and that's fine. As long as our disagreement doesn't involve either of us in sin, and I don't believe that preaching either the early date or the late date will cause anybody to sin, the message of the book that's going to be presented is essentially the same. But we're going to have a difference of opinion about when the book was written, or maybe even what the historical crisis involved in the book actually is. But here's the bottom line. It's not going to be a matter of sin. Nobody's going to be lost because we differ in this. Is there much value in pushing it and causing dissension in the congregation over that? Well, I don't see that. I don't see that value. Sometimes it would be best for me to keep my opinion, as excellent as it is, to myself because others are not properly prepared to discuss it. They may not be ready or they may not wish to discuss it. There's no point in pushing it. Another question we need to ask is, does the disagreement spring from a doctrinal issue? If we're not convinced that it is a personal matter or one's opinion, can we clearly identify it as a matter of doctrine? Do the Scriptures address the issue either directly or indirectly? If we are dealing with such a question, something that the Scriptures do address, we need to ask another question, in my opinion. I know, I'm supposed to keep my opinion to myself. Is there anybody awake out there? Another question. If it is a matter of individual activity, or is it a matter of the collective activities of the congregation? And how I deal with that matter is going to be different depending on whether it is collective responsibility or whether it's individual responsibility. If it's a matter of individual activity, then there's another question I need to ask. Is it a matter of morality? For instance, fornication is a matter that is an individual thing. It involves an individual's behavior. It is a moral matter. And it does make a difference to me. If you are engaged in fornication, it ought to make a difference to you if I am engaged in fornication. Even though I'm not involving you, it's not a collective activity, but it affects my fellowship with God and thus my fellowship with you. And so those are questions that are important. But there may be other matters that are also doctrinal matters, but that are of an individual nature and not a moral nature. Now let me explain what I mean by that. I believe the head covering of the woman fits in that category. It is an individual matter. If a woman wishes to wear a head covering in the worship assembly, then she is certainly free to do that. Her action doesn't cause anybody else to sin. Nor does, in most cases, I would say in nearly all cases, nor does somebody else's a decision not to wear a head covering usually influence the woman who thinks that she should. They each practice their conviction. It is not a matter of morality in the sense that fornication is. It is, however, a matter that is discussed in the Scriptures, and people do have different opinions or ideas about what's required. But the other question we asked is it an individual matter or a collective matter? You see, if it's an individual matter, then you can practice your conviction and it doesn't affect me, and vice versa. And that's important. There are some things that we do together that we really do need to be agreed about. If you want to bring a piano in here to use to accompany our singing, then if I'm part of this congregation and I'm participating in the worship of this congregation while somebody plays the piano, I'm now part of that decision. I may not agree with it, but I'm now part of it. I'm involved in it. And so we need to be agreed about whether we're going to have that piano or not so that we can participate in this collective activity, our singing, admonishing, and teaching one another, our worship together, in a way that all of us can agree on. But there are some other questions, even beyond that. How directly do the Scriptures speak to the subject? Do we have extensive information or very little information? There are certain things that the Scriptures do talk about that I have an opinion about as far as right and wrong, what a Christian should do or shouldn't do. But I will freely admit to you that I would like a lot more information. I'm not always certain the implications of what has been written. And I'm much less dogmatic about my opinion or my understanding of that subject than I am about some other subjects, baptism, for instance, and the part that it plays in salvation. I think the Scriptures not only speak directly to that, but rather clearly and sufficiently. But there are some other things, and I'll give you an example of that, one that is often debated among Christians, and that is the Christian's participation in warfare, in carnal warfare. Do the Scriptures speak to that subject? Well, yes, indirectly. You can argue both sides based on some principles or Scriptures, and obviously there's a truth to it, but I guess there's not as much information, nor is it as precise and clear as, say, for instance, the purpose of baptism and its role in one's salvation. Are you following what I'm saying? I'm not saying it's insignificant, but I'm saying I'm a whole lot more dogmatic about what the purpose of baptism is than I am about the question of whether or not a Christian can participate in carnal warfare. And the reason is, I understand that the Scriptures speak more directly to one subject than they do the other. They speak more extensively about some subjects than they do other subjects. And the rigidity of my position, if you pardon the expression, or my interpretation, is going to depend on some of these criteria. Well, that's the second thing we need to talk about, and that is the significance of the disagreement. Maybe that it's not something that we need to be concerned about. Maybe a matter simply of one's opinion. It may be an individual matter and not a collective matter. And so each of us can practice our conviction without impinging on somebody else's ability to worship or serve God together. Is it a matter of morality or is it simply a matter of some additional restriction or practice? And just how much information do we have about this particular topic? That's going to determine to some extent how dogmatic we may choose to be about that particular issue. The third thing that I would suggest to you is that we need to be properly prepared to discuss a disagreement. And by that I mean that, in the first place, we need to choose the proper setting and time. Brethren, one thing that I would encourage that we avoid, and that is the argument in the foyer. And I've seen this time and time again. Sometimes a preacher will say something in the sermon, and somebody really disagrees with what was said. And I'm not picking on anybody, but I understand somebody feels very strongly that what was said in the pulpit was not correct. But may I suggest to you that accosting the preacher in the foyer, in a public place, where there are sometimes immature Christians who do not understand what's going on, or sometimes even visitors who have no clue about what's being discussed, and sometimes the exchange begins to get a little heated and people begin to get excited. They begin to wonder, well, what's going on here? It's like we're having some sort of an altercation in the foyer. Brethren, that's really probably not the best way to discuss a disagreement. Maybe it would be better discussed when others are not present. The discussion may have to go beyond that. It may be a matter that needs more exposure than just the person who disagrees and the person who did the teaching. But that's a step down the road. Maybe the best thing in the beginning is for that discussion to be more private, where others are not discouraged by what's going on. And I will tell you something that all married people probably discover at some point, and that is the fatigue factor. Sometimes we force discussions with others when those people really are not well equipped at the moment to talk about it. When I'm very tired, I am less anxious to be gracious in disagreements. How many of you married people, you come home and you want to talk about it now. It's so important and you're ready to talk about it, but your mate has wrestled with 7 children all day. Yours, the neighbor's, a couple other people's. 7 children all day, the washer broke down, dog ate the cat, mower won't work, supper's burning on the stove, and you want to talk about something that's very important to you. Now understand, I'm not minimizing the importance of those kinds of discussions. I'm just saying maybe that's not the time. And if we can take it out of the home context and bring it into a discussion or a disagreement between two brethren, I would suggest the same thing. There are times when it's just not appropriate. It's just not the right time. Second thing about being properly prepared to discuss the disagreement, and I'm talking about things, these are things I need to think about before the discussion even begins, and that is I need to accept the possibility that I could be wrong. And that's a difficult thing to do. You feel very strongly that something is the case, that you have interpreted the Scriptures correctly. It's difficult to keep in the back of your mind the possibility that you may be the one who's mistaken and not the other person. 2 people involved in a disagreement who do not both allow for such a possibility are going to do battle like 2 bulls in a pasture. There's plenty of grass, but neither one of them is going to let the other one eat. And so they just knock heads, neither one willing to give any ground because they are absolutely certain that it's the other guy who's wrong. I'm not suggesting that it's wrong for us to have strong convictions. I'm saying we need to be realistic about the fact that none of us has ever perfectly interpreted the Scriptures in every case. I've made changes in things that I believe. I've sharpened my focus, I think, sometimes with a better understanding through further study of various topics. And I think you've done the same thing if you're normal. And you are. And so I go into disagreements with the idea that maybe I'm the one who needs to make the change. Maybe I'm not correct. Proverbs 13:10 says, by pride comes only contention. Pride is the problem here. Pride frequently prevents people from admitting wrong. We've got our position, and we are dug in, and we're not going to give any ground, regardless of whether the arguments on the other side are convincing, scriptural, whatever. Proverbs 16 and verse 18 says, pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. And that's a pretty good passage to address this particular idea. The third thing I would suggest is to show kindness. We need to be gentle in our discussions with one another. The example of Paul in his writing is that he would always, if there was an opportunity to do so, he would commend before criticizing. Always the sugar before the vinegar. And sometimes he wrote some pretty vinegary epistles, some fairly blunt things, some severe things to the Galatians, to the Corinthians. But where possible, he commended them, he gave thanks for them in those things that they were doing right. We need to show kindness as he did. We need to practice calmness and avoid anger. I think there's a difference between pressing one's point and being angry, but we need to be careful that if we are angry, we cool down before approaching the person that we disagree. Sometimes it's just not the time for the discussion. It needs to be put off until I can think a little more rationally. Proverbs 15:1 says, a soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Very good verse for this particular topic. In the same chapter, Proverbs 15 and verse 18, the text says, a wrathful man stirs up strife, but he who is slow to anger allays contention. The problem with when we're angry is that we tend to act or speak without thinking. Doug made that observation as he prepared our minds this evening for our topic of study. And then as we're proceeding into the discussion, as we're looking at our disagreement, What we need to do is seek agreement. We need to remember the value of unity. The psalmist said it like this in the 133rd Psalm, verse 1. He says, "Behold, how good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity." Like probably all of you, dissension, strife, discord, disagreements make me uncomfortable. I'm much more at ease if we can agree on things, if we can work together. And I understand there will be disagreements. But remembering the value of unity, the wonderful nature of being able to get along and work together, we need to pursue that and to seek agreement. And then last of all, we need to view the disagreement in the context of the total relationship. Assuming, for the sake of our discussion, that this is a disagreement between Christians, what will the relationship be like after we've tried to resolve the disagreement? And I'm not suggesting that we ought to avoid discussions of differences between us. What I am saying is we need to remember that there's an underlying relationship there that we really want to be intact when this is all over. And there are certain ways we're going to approach our differences that we'll try to sustain, try to preserve that relationship. I think that's especially a factor when opinions are what we're talking about, when the matter really involves opinion. My relationship with you is so important that there will be things that we may disagree with on, we may have different opinions, that I will not even discuss. Because I don't want to damage our, I don't want to take the chance of damaging our relationship, and frankly, it's not worth it. It doesn't make any difference. It'd be nice if we could both have the same opinion. But it's not crucial, and it's certainly not worth losing the relationship for. We're not competing against one another to see who can be right or who can get his way the most times or most of the time. And I would suggest to you finally that we need to remember in the face of disagreement just how much we have in common. And I tried to emphasize that in the beginning when I said that what's really surprising is not that we have disagreements. I think that's inevitable. What's surprising is that we don't have more disagreements. I believe the reason that's true, that so much of the time we don't have open conflict, is that a lot of things that are unimportant, we just set them on the sidelines. I believe that's what the Lord expects of us. To remember how much we have in common, how important our unity is, how important harmony is, both to the work of the congregation and to our own spiritual growth. And so let me conclude this evening by suggesting to you, first of all, that dissension is destructive. I said to you that what it does is it destroys relationships. It really distracts from the work of the local church. We're all concerned about the problems that are going on within the congregation, that we really lose our outside evangelistic focus. And I would tell you that sometimes it damages our reputation in the community so much that we find ourselves unable really to do effective evangelism. The thing about disagreements is that it's usually only when they get out of hand that we hear about them. I want you to think about this. You turn your television on tonight, you're going to watch the evening news. And the news anchor, with a very solemn face, begins reading from the teleprompter, "Today, an airliner safely landed at a major international airport and all passengers disembarked without incident. Officials with the airline reported that no luggage was lost." That's it. That's the story. Big plane landed, no problems. All the luggage was there. Which incidentally doesn't always happen, as Debbie and I have just learned. We don't hear about the good things. We don't hear about the successes. What do you hear about on the news? You hear about crime. You hear about the failures. You hear about the disasters, the calamities. You hear about all the evil things. And all I'm saying to you that to some extent, our focus may be a little out of whack. I'm not saying that we ought to ignore disagreements. What I'm saying is we oughtn't to let the occasional disagreement become like that's the real atmosphere of the congregation, because the fact of the matter is that's the exception, not the rule. But we don't report the rule, do we? We report the exception, at least on the news. People don't remember successes, only the failures. How much work gets done by members of this congregation in a harmonious, virtually frictionless way as people work together with their various talents and their different personalities and their different levels of maturity within the faith? And yet we mesh together in so many ways in a positive way. It seems somewhat of a disappointment that sometimes what really gets emphasized is any kind of disagreement. I'm not suggesting, like I say, that we submerge that and not deal with those things. I think we need to realize that that's more uncommon than common. At least I'm hoping so. That's my perception. In handling disagreements, let me just review the major points. First of all, we need to clearly identify the disagreement. Make sure we're talking about the same thing. Is there really a disagreement, or are we just not communicating very well? I've had discussions with people in Bible classes where we went back and forth for 15 minutes, and after the class figured out we were saying the same thing. Well, hello. We just wasted time because perhaps both of us were not communicating very well. Let's make sure that we understand what the disagreement is and that there even is a disagreement. Secondly, let's determine the significance of the disagreement. It may not be worth discussing any further, and certainly not having some sort of a conflict or discord over. Third, we need to be properly prepared to discuss the disagreement. And I suggested several ways in which we can prepare ourselves, not only prior to the discussion, but certainly as we try to resolve the disagreement. And then last of all, let's remember the disagreement in the context of the total relationship. This particular issue may be very important to me, but it's only one of a lot of interactions that I'm going to have with you. And so I want to structure our conversation, our discussion of our disagreement in a way that's not going to prejudice the rest of our relationship and, of course, perhaps even destroy it. Now, having said all that, and I hope some of it in a positive way, some disagreements just frankly require that brethren separate. And I want you to go back where we started, Acts 15. Paul and Barnabas, good men that they were, I'm not being critical of either one, they were unable to work together in this second journey. But you know, the irony of that is that they went their separate ways, each did what he felt was the important thing or was the right course, and what happened was twice as much work got done than perhaps would have been done in the first place had they been together. Instead, four people went out instead of two. Most disagreements, however, can be quietly and carefully resolved. But I will tell you that disagreements that are not resolved have a habit of flaring into problems that sometimes do cause serious difficulties for local congregations in addition to the individuals who are involved in the disagreement. You have listened so patiently, and I appreciate that. Psalm 133, I think, in verse 1 says a very important thing, how wonderful it is when brethren can dwell together in harmony. We sometimes describe ourselves as family, as God's family in this place. And I think that's an accurate description. Scriptures obviously talk about us as the sons of God. He's our Father, Jesus Christ, our elder brother. And I will tell you that even in families, physical families, as you know, sometimes we don't always get along. Sometimes there are difficulties, sometimes there's disagreements. But isn't it wonderful to be a part of a family? I'm talking about the physical family. Nice to have siblings, parents, grandchildren, to feel that closeness, that bond that you have that obviously is a matter of blood. Well, that same closeness is what we strive for in a spiritual way in the family of God. And it is a wonderful thing, as the psalmist says, when that closeness results in harmony and peace, when brethren are considerate of one another, gentle and kind, and they deal with disagreements or problems in a way that is befitting those who are called the sons of God. Now, if you want to be a part of that family, the Lord is opening the door for you. He offers His grace to everyone who's willing to submit to the commands of the gospel, the need to believe in Jesus as the Christ, the Son of God, and to repent of one's sins, to confess the faith that we hold in our hearts that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and then to be baptized for the remission of sins. Those are the easy and simple instructions in the Scriptures. You've heard them many times, but it may be that there's someone here tonight who wants to be part of God's spiritual family. Enjoy that closeness, that harmony that needs to exist among people who all belong to God. If we can't love one another, how can we love God? That's what the Apostle John said. But God loves us. He loves not only those who are already in His spiritual family, He loves all mankind. That's why He sent His Son to die. And so tonight, if you need to respond to the gospel, we stand to invite you as we stand and sing. If you'll come to the front, we'll assist you in whatever way possible.